Conference recording started.
I am Janet Peters, with the, I'm a project coordinator. A project coordinator with the Great Lakes ADA Center. This webinar is part of our Accessible Technology webinar series and is sponsored by both the Great Lakes ADA Center and the Pacific ADA Center. We are members of the ADA National Network. The ADA National Network is comprised of 10 regional centers that are funded by the National Institute on Disability and Rehabilitation Research. We've gone over some technical housekeeping prior to the beginning of this session. Know that that information is also available in your handouts. Closed captioning, again, is available by selecting Control F8. The session is being recorded and will be available to you in the archives at the Accessible Technology webinar site. I'm very excited to get started. We started just a couple of minutes late. The session today is on developing and implementing an accessibility strategy. And our speaker is Ken Petrie. We're very pleased to have him. Ken has directed the Ohio State University Web Accessibility Center since 2005. In his role at the center, Ken works with IT, administrative, and instructional staff in order to help promote and establish IT accessibility. He has been part of efforts to develop a strategic approaches to accessibility as an institutional priority. And he's going to share what he's learning so far with us today as an organization that is attempting to increase the accessibility on their campus. As I mentioned, Ken will take questions throughout the session in the chat area. But if your question doesn't get answered, I'm also moderating that, and we will have time at the end for question and answer scheduled into the presentation. And with that, I will turn it over to Ken to begin his session.
Thanks, Janet. Someone can hear me, can you just put a note in the chat window, just say, yes, I can hear you. Okay, great. Okay, you can stop now. Okay, I'm Ken Petrie. I direct the Web Accessibility Center, like Janet said, OSU has been in the process of supporting accessibility for a long time. It's been a priority at the university, but it's really only recently that we've started to approach this strategically, and that's kind of the topic today is looking at accessibility as an institutional strategy and priority. Let me go to the first slide. So I know when we were planning this particular session, Janet had told me that there were going to be people from all different kinds of institutions and businesses, large and small, and so I wanted to talk just a little bit about Ohio State. We've had for historically very decentralized IT. Over the last perhaps 5 or 6 years, it's become much more centralized than it was before. We've had a CIO's office for forever, but it was a very heterogeneous IT environment for the first long time that I was here. We had a central learning management system, but there were lots of other organizations inside of the university that had competing systems. That's changed quite a lot over the last few years, and so even though we're, I think, the second or third largest university in the country, we now have something that feels a lot more unified than it has in the past, and that's definitely helped with a strategic approach to accessibility, primarily by kind of limiting what we know we can support. You know, historically it had been an issue of there were so many different competing systems. How do you verify that all of those systems are accessible? How do you divide labor so that they can be handled and documented? And there just really wasn't much of a way to do that. It's become more recently a distinct possibility. We also have a really long history of support for accessibility. The ADA coordinator, Scott Listener, is the outgoing president of AHEAD, which is the national organization on disabilities in higher education. He was the one who orchestrated my being hired, this position being created. Actually, I inherited what was already a position that was run by a graduate student in 2005. And so, I've had a lot of support administratively, at least from a couple of sources. So mainly from his office and from Disability Services and my offices, with inside of the Disability Services office, and shares administrative line with the ADA coordinator's office. That being said, I felt more like someone who people would come to and if they had a particular issue. And there didn't seem to be until fairly recently a big attempt to kind of put me out there as someone who can speak to the larger community. I felt like I was kind of, I would imagine a lot of people who work in disability services generally feel this way. I was there as someone that, you know, if things were bad or if a particular unit wanted to approach accessibility, they would go and seek me out. And this is even the case when we've had a university policy on accessibility since 2004. So before I even got the job, the university had a policy supporting accessibility, and we had a set of minimum web accessibility standards since 2004. So even though those things were already in place, I felt somewhat marginalized, within the university, and that's significantly less so the case now. So, I mean, that's 10 years, right? So I guess what I'm trying to say is if you're just beginning in an organization to do this, don't expect it to happen really quickly. These things kind of are a slow burn. Let's see. So I guess we're having some audio problems. Let me turn the audio all the way up and see if that helps. Is that any better? Is anybody hearing me at all?
Yes, Ken, you sound good here. So for those of you having audio problems, you may need to adjust your speakers on your end because it is the audio is coming through your computer. So as I explained in the beginning, you need to adjust your audio settings with the microphone and the little red icon up here to set up your audio wizard. So go ahead, Ken, you sound good.
Oh, okay. All right. Thanks. In particular, because of this long-standing support, there's been, my assumption has always been that accessibility is just something that should be done. And really, when I've talked to people, that's the way they felt. They may not have necessarily been doing a whole lot of it, or have had their particular unit be able to support it. As individuals, there was a lot of support for it. So we haven't had much pushback on accessibility. And I think within, I know a lot of people from Big Ten universities, and there are people on this call from the Committee on Institutional Cooperation, which I'm a part of, which is made up primarily of Big Ten institutions, and we meet regularly to talk about these issues. And that's the general truth. We're not getting a lot of pushback. People aren't opposed to the notion of accessibility. Doesn't necessarily mean they're doing it all that well or they're putting a lot of time into it. There hasn't been a lot of pushback, but not always has there been, until recently, a lot of effort put toward it, especially in a kind of unified way. So the strategic approach for accessibility is really kind of a new thing for the university, I would say, in an organized way, probably just a couple of years old. So I'm going to go to the next slide. All right, so one of the things that I think has helped foreground this kind of concentration on accessibility over the last couple of years is what happened at Penn State. And I would imagine that most people on this call are at least loosely familiar with the Penn State settlement. In 2010, there was a complaint, an OCR complaint, the Office for Civil Rights complaint, and investigation by the National Federation for the Blind and the Office for Civil Rights of the Department of Education. And there was a settlement that occurred in 2010, and they went through a pretty thoroughgoing reorganization of how the entire institution approach accessibility. And since then, there have been a whole lot of, and this is just a partial list of some of the settlements and lawsuits. And some of these are lawsuits that were brought by individuals, students at universities, and some of them were lawsuits that were initiated by the Office for Civil Rights and the Department of Education. So Northwestern and NYU had settlements related to the use of Google Apps, Florida State, South Carolina Technical College System, Louisiana Tech. Very recently, there was a extremely important settlement at University of Montana, and then even going on in Ohio. The University of Cincinnati, which is a private school, just recently had a settlement agreement, and there's one going on at Miami University right now. And so in my role here at Ohio State, I've been collaborating with Miami, and they're putting a lot of effort into it. So this is, I don't know what business you're coming from, but I know within universities, and especially public universities, there is really a lot of organization, and it's a very hot legal environment right now. The definition of what accessibility is has been refined in a lot of these settlement agreements, and so this may be familiar to a lot of you, but this is what came out of the Youngstown State settlement. And if you look at the Louisiana settlement or the South Carolina settlement, you'll see this almost exact same language appearing. So accessible means to a person with a disability, means that a person with a disability is afforded the opportunity to acquire the same information, engage in the same interactions, and enjoy the same services as a person without a disability, and here's all the key terms: in equally effective and equally integrated manner, with substantially equivalent ease of use, and that person has to be able to obtain information fully, equally, and then this new part that was actually introduced in the Montana case, independently as a person without a disability. And then there's some hedging. Although this might not result in identical ease of use to that of persons without disabilities, it still must ensure equal opportunity to the educational benefits, and so on. So parts of that that are significant and new. As I mentioned, Montana, the Montana decision establishes independence and the notion of the same time frame. Those are from the Montana lawsuit that was just, I think it was at the toward maybe September of last year when that settlement occurred. A little bit before it, Berkeley Library had a decision on alt media, which for the first time that I know has created requirements for faculty to provide reading lists in a timeliness so that alt media can get a hold of those reading lists and transform them into something that can be used by people with disabilities. And then there was an H&R Block settlement, and it expanded the range of I can look at independence and same time frame in just a second. H&R Block settlement applied the same standard to mobile applications, and at Accessing Higher Ground, the Department of Education's Office for Civil Rights lawyer Paul Grossman said that the direction is toward no ad hoc workarounds. And so there have been some questions on the list. Let me unpack a couple of those terms. Independence, as far as the Montana decision is concerned, is that the person be able to use the technologies without a third party intervening. And some of that has to do with and kind of overlaps with the same time frame. If someone wants to look at an article in the library database, and they want to do that because they're a student at pretty late at night, they shouldn't have to call a third party in to help them with that. So that the service be delivered, whatever that service is, be delivered in the same time frame and without assistance, kind of pushes us toward what Paul Grossman was talking about. That really the goal here and what advocacy organizations like the National Federation of the Blind are pushing for, and what the OCR is pushing for, is that the technologies that you deploy be accessible and that the content be accessible. So moving away from a model of secondary accommodation and toward one where the stuff hits the ground, the technologies hit the ground accessible, and they're deployed in a way that anyone can use them, and which is very, very high and difficult to meet bar, but that is definitely where things are going. Okay, so one other thing that came out of Penn State is that, and this has been my experience at OSU too, working at the grassroots is a necessity, but it's definitely not enough. You will need some kind of upper level administrative support to get done what you need to get done. There has to be buy-in from senior leadership in order to really achieve what needs to be achieved. That's not to say that you wait for that and do nothing, but grassroots efforts, especially at a large organization, are not going to get the job done. And this is very much the case in higher education, where you have a fairly distinct cultural divide between staff and, say, faculty. And if you want faculty to do something, you're going to need a certain level of pressure. And this maybe is even the case with mainstream IT. Accessibility has been kind of marginal within IT for a long time. So if you want to make it central to your IT practices, you need someone who has enough power to basically say, you know, make it central. So what happened, this slide is just a list of some of the things that have happened at Penn State. So they formed a central committee on EIT, that's electronic information technologies. They created a system of department and unit liaisons. So there's a central committee with communities of practice in each of the subdisciplines that had that have liaisons that report to the central committee. So you know, if you're going to organize someone, say like the print designers group within your marketing and communications department, what the best way to foster accessibility within those groups is to talk to them in their own language and let them develop their own set of skills around accessibility and establish, this is the notion of a community of practice, establish a community of practice within their group rather than trying to impose something on them from the outside. And I'll talk more about this a little bit later, but that approach is fundamental to what we're trying to do at Ohio State. So they also needed to do an accessibility audit of all of their technology environment, which at a university is no mean feat. That is a lot of systems. And if you go out onto the EDUCAUSE website and look at the settlement agreement, you'll see that they had a very compressed calendar for doing that audit. I think it was, you know, a matter of months, in fact. They established an electronic and information technology policy statement. So they had a policy statement, and then they had guides to develop accessibility strategies within each of the units and to implement them across all of the disciplines. They also implemented training and instruction, and they created procedures that require the university to purchase or recommend only accessible electronic and information technology, unless it was not feasible to do so. So in certain cases, and this is going to always be the case, there are certain things that can't be made fully accessible, or there will be a business need that overrides the what is the accessibility need. And I've been in this exact situation many times. It's not a very comfortable one. You end up having to purchase a system because there's a business need that you know has accessibility holes in it. And you know, in that situation, what you need to do is just be diligent. And if you've got administrative support, you can enforce in contract language with the vendor some sort of timetable for remediation of the accessibility problems with the product that you're buying. Okay, so getting back a little bit to the previous slide, what Ohio State has done is create accessibility strategies. So right now we have three strategies in place. And the strategies are, there's no kind of one, you know, university-wide strategy. There have been, I'm getting a message on my screen. Oh, I'm just going to cancel that. There's no one university overarching strategy. Instead, our approach has been to develop strategies within the larger business units in the university. So right now,
hi, Tim. Sorry to interrupt you. We have an issue with the telephone audio. If you can hold while we establish that reconnection, you'll probably see a box, and you don't click on anything until we get that connected.
Okay. If people want to ask questions in the chat, I can answer in the chat.
Line muted.
I'll look back.
Line unmuted.
Okay, if you want to do a sound check for me, Ken.
Okay. Am I being heard?
Yes, that's great. You can continue now.
Okay, so there was an example, or there's a question in the chat about is there a template or example available of an accessibility audit? Right now, if somebody wants, I didn't include it. I've got some materials at the end of the presentation that I'll share with people, and I can talk about what they are. I didn't include one of our audits in them, but I can. I'll make a note to talk about what we do in our audit process a little bit later on, and if somebody wants to contact me, well, you know what I can do? Okay, I'll add in the sort of no content template for what we do. It's not all that helpful, honestly. Basically, what it is we give the application a score having to do with what we perceive as its risk to the organization and what we perceive as its current level of accessibility, and we provide a kind of high-level summary of what are the major issues that we're seeing. So not particular issues, but what are the sort of global issues that we're seeing in terms of accessibility. And then we'll provide a recommendation. So the recommendation usually has something in it like, we're seeing these issues right now. We gave it a risk assessment of high critical because of the population of students that are going to be accessing it and how many students are going to be accessing it. And we recommend that there be an accessibility exception until the application can be made accessible. And I'll talk more about accessibility exceptions in a second. And then we'll give a list of issues. That's typically the format that we do. And if people want to, I'll stick a kind of naked version of that in the materials that are at the end of this session. I've got a zipped file with a bunch of other documents in it, and I'll add one of those into it. Okay. So, like I said, we've got now three accessibility strategies that are floating around, and those are all also in the materials at the end. And the thing that's immediately noticeable about all of them is they're very dissimilar. They have some similarities, and I'm going to talk about those in just a second. But really, they're tailored to the unit's needs. So the CIO's office, our student life office, and then ODEE, which is online and distance education, they all have vastly different strategic goals. And so what they did is they wrote, with our help, they wrote accessibility strategies that address their own business needs, right? What are their own organizational goals? How can they make those goals also achieve this kind of larger goal of becoming accessible? And we allow them to set their own timetables. But the one thing we do want in those, and those agreements are reviewed by our ADA coordinator, and in effect signed off by our ADA coordinator. We think about them in terms of a contract. So we can't do excessive monitoring of all these different groups, but if it becomes obvious that they're not meeting or not even trying to meet, say, for example, the timetable that they've set out for themselves, that becomes a problem. It hasn't happened yet, so we don't know what we do if it becomes a problem. But they're presented to us, these accessibility strategies are presented to us as a contract between the ADA coordinator's office and the business units themselves. Okay. So, like I said, all of them are very different, but some of the things have common threads. There's all of these units are doing some sort of purchasing of third-party products, and they're doing their own internal development. So their own internal development should be done accessibly, and they should partner with us to try to guarantee that it's done in an accessible fashion. And then if they're going and they're looking for third-party vendors, we've developed some standard boilerplate contract language that goes out in the request for proposal at the beginning of the purchasing process, and then we also have some contract language that they can use. In addition, there are some questions that we recommend they ask of vendors. And since these RFP documents have been available, the Office for the CIO has baked them into all of their enterprise-level purchasing procedures. So we've seen those used in probably four or five purchasing procedures, and other units are using versions of those to do both their RFPs and when it comes time to ink a contract with a vendor. The other thing that's in these is some ability to prioritize. So, you know, this is a lesson that we learned from Penn State, you know, treat the things that are bleeding the most as the highest priority. So things that are already known to have major accessibility problems and are in front of, say, students, those are going to be addressed before anything else. So there needs to be a prioritization and some notion of a risk assessment done. Then for as evaluation of products and services occur, there should be some sort of standardization of those procedures. So, and what we have now is, like, if something is identified as a problem, there needs to be a remediation plan created around that product, and if it's found that this piece of technology can't be made accessible in the short term, we go through a process with the ADA coordinator of writing an exception. So the exception document is in the materials at the end of the of this webinar. Yes, and can I share the RFP language and contract? Yes, I can. In fact, I will give the URL out for that. All of the RFP language that we have is at least the sort of generalized versions of it is available publicly. And I'm, you know, I don't want to claim that it's the best. It's certainly not. We see it as something that's living, and if we can make corrections to it or improvements to it, we'll certainly do that. We have made it public. The exception policy and accommodation plans are also in the documentation at the end. So essentially what would happen in the case of an exception is the unit that owned that particular piece of software, whether it's third party or internally developed, would answer a number of questions in a form, basically saying, well, what are they going to do if somebody comes and has a problem with the software? What are you going to do to provide 24/7 service for a piece of software that's that's critical to say a student registering for a class or something that's extremely time sensitive? And the exception is set up to specify what happens in those circumstances. And the idea there, in part at least, is to if we were to ever come under legal scrutiny, we wanted to have the documents of these exceptions so that we could say, like, well, okay, yeah, we know this is a problem. Here's how we've been addressing it. And I know that's not going to get us off the hook legally, but at least it shows that we're aware and we've got a calendar for addressing this. The exceptions are designed to be temporary exceptions. They're not, that's not a permanent state of being. It's a temporary exception. We're also starting to, we've been doing for quite a while, some level of training, and now the training is being centralized within the unit. So the OCIO is developing its training, and ODE is developing some training for faculty, and OCIO is developing some training for staff. And we've done a lot of speaking to the development teams, making sure that accessibility is a part of their workflow. Also, if faculty are creating a lesson plan, that they know how to do it with inside of our content management system in a way that's accessible. Or if they're using a third-party tool, we're trying to buy third-party tools to record lectures and tools to create content and lesson plans that we know to be accessible. And then this notion of transparency. I've spoken a number of times and given out the various versions of these plans, and at some point we're going to make all of the plans publicly available to everyone. That should happen within the next few months. We want the and I think that's, I mean, depends how you, how your organization runs, but I don't think it hurts you to be really honest about where you stand. People in who are on this call from the CIC will back me up on this. They've said, we've heard from people that we've spoken to in some of the larger advocacy groups, specifically the National Federation for the Blind and some of the lawyers that work with them, that it's better for us if we just immediately own up to where, what our deficiencies are, and that we have plans in place for making things better. Okay. So there's a question in the chat. What is the legal basis for these standards? Access Board guidance. Could you clarify which standards are our own minimum web accessibility standards? So first, I'm not talking about physical environment stuff at all. So there really isn't anything in ADA regulations on electronic materials. So our own minimum web accessibility standards were originally derived from 508, and they've been, that was because when they came around, it was 2004. And we then moved them toward WCAG 2 when WCAG 2, the settlement terms. I don't think I can answer the question. So the chat said, what is the legal basis for the standards, access board guidance, or ADA regulations? The settlement terms, I don't know, frankly. Maybe somebody else can address that. As far as our own internal standards go, our minimum web accessibility standards are based on 508 and have been updated to be to point toward the Web Content Accessibility Guidelines version 2. Okay. If there's a little bit of time, I can I'll give out the URL. Actually, you know what? I'm just going to paste the URL in here now so that people can take a look at this. Okay, so if you go to that URL that I just put in the chat, that'll take you to our minimum web accessibility standards. There's a table there, and that same page also has our RFP, sort of a kind of a generic version of our RFP and contract language. Okay, so some of the broad lessons from this. One that I wish didn't necessarily have to be the case, but I think is definitely the case, you need to find some way of obtaining senior administration or leadership support. We at OSU are in the process of forming a central committee, an IT accessibility committee. It should happen in relatively short order. And I think in terms of this, we're actually behind a lot of the other universities within the Big Ten. Most of the ones that I talk to fairly regularly already have some sort of central committee on IT accessibility. Following from that central committee, you're going to want to establish unit and organization liaisons, so people within the various business units within the organization who can communicate with the central committee. And one thing we have done on this is establish communities of practice. So we do have a number of those. Also, number two, establish guidelines and support them with a policy. So you want a policy for your organization, and a capital P policy supported at the highest levels of the organization, backed up by guidelines. And the way that we've done it is we like to leave our guidelines to be sort of an open living document. They're based on the Web Content Accessibility Guidelines, but we've tooled them to fit into our own organization's way of doing things. You want to create information awareness and training around the guidelines and policy. I would say we probably haven't done as good a job as we probably should have, but I think we're getting better at it. It's a difficult thing to do. We have been brought into, and this is me, primarily me and my colleagues in the OCIO have been brought into a number of recent hiring procedures where we're sitting on the committees and helping in the interviewing process for developers and for instructional designers that the people who are brought in have more than just a sort of lip service notion of what accessibility is, that they actually have a pretty solid notion of that. And I think we've been fairly effective in influencing hiring decisions because of that. Would you please give an example for bullet one? Okay, so if you go to that link, we have down, so it's in the go.osu.edu/MWAS. There's a table about midway down the page that is our guidelines. And so on the left-hand side, it's stuff that's basically pulled from 508. It's 508 with a little bit of sauce from 2004 at OSU, right? So, but for the most part, 508. And then in the middle, there's a mapping between that guideline and the WCAG guidelines and a set of guidelines that was produced by the state of Illinois called the Illinois Information Technology Accessibility Act. And then in the right-hand column, and this is probably what you're referring to, we've taken all of that 508 and kind of moved it through WCAG, and then we've said, well, this is what a developer needs to do when they go about implementing something that's a web service or a web application or website. These are the sort of high level things that someone developing content for the web should be aware of. I think that'll become clear if you look at that particular document. I mean, but you know, the intention there was really, you know, WCAG is a pretty complicated specification or recommendation, and if you just throw it at a developer, or even worse, if you throw it at someone, you know, a faculty who needs to create content for the web, you can just forget about them. Forget about anything being done. So if my recommendation would be, if you're going to adopt WCAG and WCAG 2 AA, level AA is sort of the standard that most organizations are adopting, and you know, you should adopt that, but try to deliver it to the people within your organization in a way that makes sense to how they go about doing their work. Whether that's something like our table, and our table may not be the best way of doing it, something that kind of understands what they need to do and pulls from WCAG to allow them to do what they need to do in a way that's accessible. Something else that we've done, and there's at the end of this presentation, there's a link to a bunch of documents, and one of those documents has our risk prioritization plan. It's a draft plan, but it's actually the one we're using. We needed some way of saying, okay, well, what do we tackle first, and how, when we are evaluating a new product, do we say that this particular product is of critical importance and it must be accessible? So we created some way to prioritize risk for products, and some way to say, well, which one should we look at first? And then you're probably going to need to allow for exceptions. And I don't think anybody here really likes our notion of exception. You don't want to have to write an exception around something. But we've written, I think, 4 at this point. And there's just a necessity. Sometimes you know that certain pieces of technology that you deploy are not going to meet the needs of all of your users. So you have to find a way to guarantee that that's known, that it's not going to do that, and that there'd be some way of making a temporary accommodation around that thing, and emphasis on temporary. And that's what our exception plan tries to do. Create procurement and development guidelines, and I've talked quite a bit about that already. And this, I think, is has certainly the thing that's been key to buy-in within the university. So you can get administrative buy-in, but never underestimate the creativity of individual units in trying to say that they're already complying with that. The way to get around that problem is have them develop their own plan. Have the units develop their own, say, I'm going to meet these goals and here's how we're going to do it. And that does a couple things. It honors their own business needs, but it also creates a sense of ownership. So if that group has developed their own plan and they're happy internally with how that's been authored and it meets their own business needs, they're much more likely of achieving the goals that it sets out. And then finally, how do you measure success? And there's one thing that I left off the slide, which I'll talk about. So, you can do self-reporting. We've tried to get that going, and it hasn't happened. We do occasional automated scans, but unlike a lot of universities, and we're behind a lot of universities in this sense, we don't have any single, kind of high-level view of where the university is doing really well in terms of accessibility, and where it's not doing as well in terms of accessibility. We will have some. We're kind of waiting for some tools to develop, people from the CIC will know what I'm talking about. In particular, I'm talking about the Functional Accessibility Evaluator. That's a project out of the University of Illinois, and that's what we would like to adopt here as the primary tool that we use for getting a sort of global sense of the of website accessibility. But even those things, you know, automated scans won't catch everything. And in fact, they'll often not catch enough. And self-reporting, well, you know, it depends who's doing the reporting. I think self-reporting is a great idea. But I don't know how effective it would be in all units here. So, we haven't gotten it off the ground. I think it's probably a long-term goal for us. The one thing we have done, though, which is not on this slide, is we've been tracking stuff. So as we move through evaluations, we keep a document history of those evaluations and the issues and how the issues are being resolved. And for us, at least, that's as far as we've gotten down the measuring success path of things at this point. We want to continue to do evaluations, and we want to have a sense of those evaluations getting to the right people, the right people knowing where we are judging the level of criticality of that particular piece of software. You know, how what is going to be the impact of it? What is going to be its risk to the university? And we want to be able to track reactions. So it's a pretty informal system at this point. We're actually developing a piece of software that will allow us to track it a little bit more closely. Right now it's just the campus has Box, which is a document sharing software, and we just create a new folder every time we look at a piece of software, and we keep all of the information regarding that piece of software and where it stands in terms of accessibility, our initial reports and the follow-up on those reports inside of that Box folder. And it's pretty primitive, but it's meeting needs currently. We hope to improve it. This last major bullet point here hits some pretty difficult stuff. So it's myself and just a couple of other people at the university who have deep knowledge of accessibility. We're stretched pretty thin. So one thing that you need people like that at your university, or at your organization, hire someone or develop someone, send people to training so that they can get a comprehensive knowledge of accessibility. It's a needed and very important effort. If you can find some way to make sure that when new developers and new personnel are brought on, especially personnel that would be creating content for the web or working in the libraries, creating PDFs or remediating PDFs, if you can hit them during the hiring process and have some form of vetting of their abilities, during that, I think that can be exceptionally helpful. So there's a question. Can someone give me the full name of the Montana decision? I can. If somebody else in the room knows the URL, that would be awesome. I can try to pull it up, but I just don't have it open in a window right now. Oh, excellent. Thank you. Then there's another question. Do you folks have a specific set of criteria for assessing whether a piece of software or hardware qualifies for an exception? Who takes responsibility for the decision? So the ultimate decision on accessibility whether or not something gets an exception is the ADA coordinators. So he's the one who says yes, this exception is approved, or no, it's not. But the exception is drafted by the business unit itself. And it's always drafted in a, there's at least initial discussions with the ADA coordinator's office and my office and the accessibility analyst who works within the OCIO, and other personnel to sort of decide what is an acceptable exception and what should be the, you know, what's an accessible time frame for that exception to be in place. As far as what qualifies it for getting an exception, that's a really, really hard question to answer, primarily because usually when a business unit is to the point where they're bringing on a new piece of software, they want that piece of software and they're going to find a way to get it. And, you know, so sometimes you may have to, just let it occur. And in a lot of cases, you can't really interrupt the process. All you can do is kind of intervene in the process and sort of add to the process this notion of exception. And I think that's one of the things that's been really effective about the exceptions is, you know, even if something does get pushed through and we know it has issues, at least there's some, you know, document that says, yeah, we've looked at it, we've got an evaluation of it, and we've had to, because we don't think it meets the needs of all of our users, we've created some way to work around its deficiencies in the short term. And I think that has a, you know, you go through it if you're a business unit and you go through that process once, because it's not a very comfortable process, and it can be an expensive process because it's meant things for us, like we've had to set up some form of 24/7 service in case a student would call in, that has been something that's been very difficult for some units to deal with. They don't want to do that. Okay, so I imagine whether it's academic or administrative is a factor. Yes, absolutely. Most of the administrative stuff can wait, and our prioritization list, which is in, I'll give people the link right now. There's the URL that has our priority list and all of the current individual unit strategies in it, and has our a draft of, actually I think it has our working exception document in it. It's without a question. It's always been if it's something that administrators or staff are going to be dealing with, we've prioritized it down. You know, it hasn't been it doesn't get critical as its grade for the impact that it will have. You know, its risk assessment is graded down. The stuff that students see, really, really, really important that stuff be as accessible as possible. There's a different line for complaints that are brought by students versus ones that are brought by staff. So yeah, as far as our priorities go, students first. That doesn't mean that we're ignoring other systems. It just means that, you know, we've prioritized them differently. Any other questions? People are welcome to contact me offline. Here's my email. Oops. And I'm happy to address questions, or if you want to write me and then chat over the phone, that's great too. I think I got people out of here about a half hour early.
Okay, this is Janet. Thank you, Ken. Before we wrap it up, because we do have time, let's give people one last chance. I was monitoring, and I think all of the questions were answered, but if you have any final questions, now would be a great time to do this. The slides, someone asked for the link. These slides are available on the Accessible Technology webinar page where you've got the link for the session. So the handouts are available. And that also includes Ken's contact information. Any final questions? Give people a chance to type, okay. Okay, barring... Ken, I'll let you go ahead and answer that final question.
Sure. If someone could repost the one from Bill Grubaugh, I'm assuming, up above. I don't think I saw that one. There's one from, okay, it's just scrolled out of view. Let me pull back up to it. There's Bill's. Okay, I'll get to Bill's in just a second. So Section 508 standards are specifically meant for federal agencies, only applicable to federal agencies. Had Ohio adopted them into the state law. Okay, so not Ohio per se, but the city of Columbus did. We just pulled from them in 2004 because those were the ones that seemed like most agencies were starting to adopt. I don't think it was much more of a decision than that at that point. The university isn't bound by 508, and it's not, and obviously it's not bound by WCAG because WCAG's not a law. It's bound by ADA Title II and 504, which don't say anything specifically about access to electronic technology. So you can pull what standard you want. If you're going to be looking at standards right now, the international standards are WCAG or other of the specifications, the recommendations from the World Wide Web Consortium, and so that's where you should probably look for information technologies accessibility standards at this point. And Bill says, given the educational environment and purpose of a university to provide education to students, does OSU administration perceive providing accessible education environment and the products that it uses in a course as a business need? This question is asked because business needs drive procurement of products. I don't know how they view it, honestly. I think in a lot of ways, the way... for better or for worse, they view it in terms of risk to the university. At the beginning of the presentation, I sort of rattled off a bunch of case law, and there's more of it out there than that. There's even more in Ohio. So we've got Youngstown and University of Cincinnati and now Miami, and we sort of see it. If you just look at a map of Ohio, you can kind of see the legal bombs dropping, kind of surrounding the university, and we don't want to be right in the center. I think that's a fairly. I mean, you hate to make the argument that way, but I think that can be perceived as a business need, right? If you don't want something to massively interrupt and define how you do business, you should probably try to avoid legal entanglement. And, that's certainly not why I got into it, and that's not my primary interest in any of this. But I think as a tool for motivating change, the lawsuits have been a good thing. And and they've gotten a lot of attention from upper administration. So Let's see. What does the same time frame mean in the Montana decision? I don't have the same time frame language in front of me right now. How we have interpreted it here is depending on the on how critical that piece of software is to getting a some critical action accomplished. Right. So if it's a student registering for class and they've got a registration window and they need to meet that window, that's where the notion of same time frame becomes so important. Or if a student is studying for an exam, they've got an exam tomorrow and the content hasn't been delivered to them in an accessible format, that's where a notion of within the same time frame becomes critical. I don't know if I can explain it any better than that. One of the things that I think everybody who attended Accessing Higher Ground heard when they were listening to Paul Grossman talk is that OCR is moving toward this notion of no ad hoc solutions. Right? So, and I think this is in part addressing this notion of same time frame. If the thing is accessible out of the gate, if it's born digital and born accessible, then you don't have to worry about something being delivered in the same time frame. That's what you're going to get. The student can log on, use it in exactly the same way access the same content with as effectively as any other student, and not have to wait for to call in to a service. When his dorm mate can log on their computer and register, but he has to pick up the phone to register, and the phone line is only open during the normal business hours. That is not the same time frame. Okay. Any other questions? Please tell me if I've missed something. If we come to one above regarding 508. Let's see. Oh, my understanding is that 508 applies to all federally funded agencies, meaning if you receive federal grants, you must comply. No, that's actually not the case. So 508, or at least the 508 that it concerns electronic technology, so this is 508.1194.22, that only applies to federal agencies, so not to people who do business with federal agencies. So we have to comply to Section 504, and we may have to comply with certain parts of 508, but it's not been something that we've discussed at all. It's just that one of the reasons 508 is there is they needed some guidelines for, 504 says you must be accessible. We don't have any real understanding of what that means, so there's 508 for you. Right? But we're not required to comply to 508 just because we receive. We have to comply to 504 because we receive federal funds in the form of research dollars, in the form of financial aid. If you receive even a penny of financial aid that's federally sponsored, you must comply with Section 504. And because we're a public institution, we have to comply with ADA Title II. Yeah, and someone's talking about a refresh for 508. That's right. There is no timeline. We've heard about the 508 refresh for at least 4 years. And the last sorts of things I heard were that there was going to be some level of harmonization between the WCAG guidelines and the 508 guidelines.
Okay, are there any final questions? I'm not seeing any chats coming through, so I think we will begin to conclude. Please do share your opinion and thoughts on the session and give us suggestions and feedback. We do read your evaluations and do the planning for the Accessible Technology webinar series based on evaluations. And join us for the next session, which is going to be on March 19th on speech recognition. Thank you, and this concludes the session.
Thanks, everyone.